Good morning. I'm Rob Dillard, and it's Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. Our resident movie critics Tom Beal and Lauren Soleil are in our studios in Ames to talk about the current movie scene. We'll take a tour of the local movie houses to see what's currently playing. We'll also look ahead to the rest of the summer to find out what films might draw us out of the heat. And if you prefer to stay home for your movie viewing, we'll offer some ideas on recently available DVDs. The Cannes Film Festival wrapped up a couple of weeks ago, and there wasn't an American film among the winners. We'll ask why in the next hour. And we'll remember some Hollywood figures who have died, including Dennis Hopper. We'll begin Movie Day on Talk of Iowa after the news. Good morning. Welcome to Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Rob Dillard, and with me today from our studios in Ames are Tom Beal and Lauren Soleil. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Rob.
Welcome back to the show, Lauren.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yes.
Just the beginning of summer, time to pick up all the raft of films that will be coming out in the next, month, 2 months. So.
Well, we are starting that summer movie season. A lot of films being released to the theaters. Are any of them good?
Well, Rob, I've been thinking about that. I guess we're lucky if we get one really good film a week. Maybe I should revise it and say if we're lucky we get one good film a month. I think the films so far. Now, technically, summer business starts this last weekend, but we all know in the last few years the studios have been releasing the films earlier and earlier to avoid the jam-up that occurs sometimes at the theaters. And in addition, they have the problem of many of the films coming out in 3D, and there are only so many 3D screens. This has not been a good start. So far, the business is down 15% from last year at this time. I think we can conclude it's because most of the movies are pretty weak, and even the movies that are being heavily advertised and promoted, I think, have been disappointing. And so far, I've just not been impressed with what's been out there.
Well, one of those films that was really advertised, very heavily promoted, was Robin Hood. And that clearly hasn't done what the makers wanted it to do.
Yeah, but that's the one of the list that I particularly like. I think it's one of the better pieces that's out there. It's not doing much business, as you point out. It only took in $13 million for a total of $86 million. But I read that pictures set in the medieval period have tended not to be big draws. Robin Hood, of course, is a title that has had such a long time appeal, and many, many pictures have been made with Robin Hood as the focus. But this particular take is different from the ones that have been out there in the past, so that's one of the things I liked about it. Of course, it falls right about in the middle. It's 5 out of the top 10 this week. The number one picture is actually a film in its second week. It's unusual for a film to maintain the top grossing position, 2 weeks in a row, and Shrek Forever After has. It's the fourth installment in that series, and a lot better than the third, but the bean counters think that it's not doing the business that it was expected to do because there was so much disappointment with the third episode of the Shrek series.
That's one of the 3D ones, right?
Well, you can see it in 3D. They're all smart enough to release these films in both flat and 3D. And in my case, I have been paying the extra money, getting the glasses, and seeing the films available in 3D in 3D. But I have to say that for this one, I didn't think it was going to add much, so I went to see the flat version. And I couldn't see where 3D would have added anything to the story, which I should hasten to say I did like better than the third version, but I think we're done. That series has run completely out of gas. But it's a clever idea. It's a plot where you have simultaneous, it's a little like It's a Wonderful Life. Shrek finds out what happens if he isn't there, and he gets to see the two time periods. And from that standpoint, it's pretty clever, I think. But it's, as I say, better than the third, not as good as the first, and so it's just kind of limping along. But give it credit, it's kind of a clever idea.
The voice work for the Shrek series has always been good.
Well, I think so, although I guess to be honest, again, I'm getting a little tired of Mike Myers' Scottish, is it a brogue? It's not exactly a brogue, the way he does it, but that's wearing a little bit thin. What's happened is they've taken a character, an ogre who's supposed to be, you know, a bad guy, and it made him a lovable character, and in this movie, he's married, he's got these little children, he's got Donkey as his friend. You know, everything is just kind of boring for him. It's all wonderful and boring, and he's just, and that kind of triggers the story. And so what would happen if, if he's just tired of this life and he gets growly and gets more like an ogre should be, I guess. I think there's not enough Donkey. I think that's the best character in the movie. I wish there had been more of Donkey, but he takes kind of a minor role in the last three episodes.
That's voiced by Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy. And I just get a kick out of the character. Incidentally, the heavy in this film is Rumpelstiltskin, voiced by Walt Dorn. And he is in this parallel universe, and he's in charge now of the land of Far, Far Away. And Puss in Boots has gotten put on quite a bit of weight, and he can barely move around. And I mean, there's some funny gags there. So the picture holds up, you know, fairly well. But as I say, when you get to the end of it, you kind of say, okay, it's time to let it go.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that obviously summer films often consist of remakes or extensions of previous movies, capitalized on the previous movies, box office appeal, publicity, whatever. And I think that's probably true of a lot of the animated ones. And Jeffrey Katzenbach, who's one of the big drivers in the industry, is convinced that 3D is the way the industry, in fact, is going to go for everything. So we're probably going to see a lot more 3D movies. I think it's been easier with the animated films to sort of put them into 3D format. But I think we're going to see a lot more 3D.
It is ironic that when 3D first came out in the 50s, it was live action that was shot in 3D. They use a different process today than they did in the 50s with the House of Wax, and in particular, which was one I saw as a kid and which really had some neat 3D effects. But it was a real cumbersome and expensive process. It is now possible to take a picture shot flat and turn it into a 3D film, apparently not prohibitively expensive. But I think if you don't plan on using and taking advantage of that three-dimensional effect when you originally shoot the movie, then it's not going to be much when you turn it into 3D. And I think that's what happened with Alice in Wonderland, a picture that is now out in DVD, incidentally, and Blu-ray, which was shot flat, turned into 3D. That's the way I saw it. And I wasn't that impressed with it at the time. But I have to tell you, it's one of those movies that stuck in my head. And I think I'm probably going to cough up the money and buy a DVD version of it, because it is a story that I like so much, and it is a different take.
Let me give the phone number out for people if they'd like to join the conversation about movies. 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Another film released over the weekend, Sex and the City, the second version of that. I have to say I rented or got from the library the first Sex and the City and tried to watch it with my partner over the weekend. And after about 20 minutes, I think I'd seen enough.
Well, the interesting thing about that picture is that 86% of the audience for that film is female. And interestingly enough, for Prince of Persia, the overwhelming percentage of viewers is male. But in the case of Sex and the City, this episode has gotten terrible reviews. They took it to Abu Dhabi, I think. They took it to the Middle East.
Right.
Now, can you imagine anything more conflicting? Three independent American women who dress flamboyantly and who behave as free spirits, and then they go to a culture that is much more regimented and conservative. It just, I'll tell you right now, I haven't seen the film because although I enjoyed the television series, and the first film was interesting, but not a film that I would ever want to see again. But this one just didn't appeal to me at all, and I didn't go see it.
Well, I enjoyed the TV series too, but I was struck how the characters did not translate well to the big screen. I just did not find them as interesting as I did on the TV series.
Yes, apparently, yeah, we were talking about the first film, That was the criticism of the first film. And in fact, a lot of people who were fans of the TV show were quite disappointed that somehow they hadn't managed to, I don't know, create the same characters. I'm not quite sure. The transfer from the small screen to the big screen, you'd think they would be able to. It's not, you know, they're not doing Hamlet here. You'd think they would be able to make that transition.
I remember one scene I saw. The theater was fairly full, and it was a scene in which the Carrie, the actress's name is slipping my mind, but she's the lead actress. Anyway, she's in a beauty salon or something, and they have apparently taken all her makeup off. And so suddenly we see a close-up of her without makeup. I think the audience gasped. I think I did. This was on a big, huge movie screen, pretty revealing.
Well, Sex and the City was all about clothes and makeup and largely shoes. That part of an urban woman's world. So, yeah, and it's all about, and of course that's a very artificial in some ways kind of world, but it was also, you know, it's a world of what is it? Sex and the City got women drinking martinis again, various mixed drinks again. So it obviously had an enormous impact, but whether it translates, whether this kind of thing translates or not, let me give you a summer movie that maybe at least some people will enjoy. I want to talk about Letters to Juliet.
Okay. I did want to get to that, so yeah.
Okay, ahead. Well, let me start off with that, since we had one sort of negative summer review. Yeah, go ahead.
I tell you what, we've only got a minute before we take a break,
okay,
Lauren. So why
don't
we
come back to that?
Come back to you right as soon as we get back from the break. And let me get out the phone numbers again. It's 1-866-780-9100. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, Tom, you were talking about Sarah Jessica Parker, the lead.
How do we forget?
All right. We're coming up on 10:19 on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Rob Dillard, back with Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. With me in Ames, Tom Beal and Lauren Zelay, our resident film critics. Lauren, let's get back to Letters to Juliet, a film that you have seen recently.
Well, there seems to be a whole subgenre of letter movies, and I'm not referring to the Betty Davis the letter, but that can, it can go back that far. But a whole, and it, what is it? Love Letters is another film that's out this year. There's a film, and it's missing my, I'm not remembering it right now, perhaps one of our listeners will, involving a lost love letter takes place in a resort area. Anyway, I don't want to go into that. But here's another one, Letters to Juliet. This is a story about a young woman played by Amanda Seyfried, who she is a fact checker for the New Yorker magazine. And she is engaged to a young Italian man, who's going to open a restaurant in New York, played by Gael Garcia Bernal. The last time we saw him, he was playing Che Guevara. So this is a very different kind of role. And they have decided to take what she describes to her boss as a sort of a pre-honeymoon. They're going to go to Italy and presumably spend some time before they get married. Well, as it turns out, they in fact do go to Italy, but the Italian trip is basically a trip for Bernal, the Bernal character, to talk to his suppliers, wine people, the cheese people, the you know, et cetera, the people he's going to be using in opening his restaurant. And their headquarters, of course, in Verona. And Verona, as we all know, is the town of Romeo and Juliet. So at some point, she's left pretty much on her own. She accompanies him for a little while, but then sort of gets tired of, you know, tasting cheese and wine or whatever. So she wanders around the city and wanders into the House of Juliet. In the city of Verona, there is a house which is designated as Juliet's house. It, in fact, has a little balcony. Of course, this is all sounds very fictional, but... And people go there, and when the young woman goes there, she sees a whole bunch of young women writing letters and sticking them in the wall. And so at closing time, she notices another young woman who comes in with a basket and pulls all the letters out of the wall. She follows this woman and finds that there are a number of women, five, I think, altogether, who answer these letters. And they are the Juliets. Answering the letters to Juliet, and Amanda Seyfried decides to join. She has lots of time. They're looking for somebody to write English, and so she joins them. And the next day or several days later, she finds a letter in a niche in the wall that is moves a block of stone, and the letter is, I think, 50 years old. But she decides that even though it's 50 years old, she'll answer it anyway, and she does, and it's to a woman who lives in England. And sure enough, all of a sudden, this woman, played by Vanessa Redgrave, shows up with her her grandson, Charlie, and he, by Christopher Egan, and she's going to search for this young man that 50 years ago she had fallen in love with, but somehow left Italy and never followed up on, you know, reconnecting with him. Meanwhile, she's gotten married and had children, and subsequently her husband has died, so she's now single and older, and her son is decided to think, or her grandson thinks this whole thing is absolutely lunatic, but he's accompanied her because she can't travel alone. That's the basic premise. They discover, she knows his name, and tells this to the Seyfried character, who says, look, I'm a fact checker. I think I can narrow it down. Maybe we can find this person. And that's the original sort of the connection. They're going to take a car and drive around through central Italy, and they're going to locate, I don't know what they have, maybe a dozen people with this man's name, and see if they can locate him, which leads us up now to the final premise of the film, which is, is the Vanessa Redgrave character going to find the man that she once left X number of years ago? And B, is the young woman who's engaged to the energetic and passionate Italian who's going to open the restaurant in New York, but seems to have more passion for the restaurant than he does for his girlfriend, is she going to fall in love with this stuffy upper middle class Englishman who, of course, initially they have this absolutely oil and water kind of connection. They're just at each other's throats, and that's what's the the film sets up, and of course then it works itself out. I won't disclose what happens. However, I will say it is a romantic comedy, so you can fill in the blanks.
We should also mention that the man of this older woman's desires is played by Franco Nero.
Right, but I wasn't going to mention that because, of
course,
we didn't know whether she was going to find him or not. But yes, you're right. A sort of grizzled Franco Nero, who actually looks pretty good.
Yeah, I thought the connection with Vanessa Redgrave and Franco Nero again together was an interesting idea.
Right. And you might explain. Go ahead and explain their connection.
Well, they go way back. Why don't you tell the
Go on. Go ahead. It has to do with Guinevere, right?
Yeah, it goes back to Camelot.
Camelot, yeah. And Franco Nero plays the man who comes in and upsets Camelot by falling
That's
in
right.
love with the queen and violating the knightly code and all of that sort of thing. Anyway, so that's the setup. It's a predictable, it's not particularly a brilliant movie, But, you know, the people are kind of fun to watch, and the Italian settings are wonderful, and it's got food in it and love and lots of sunshine. I mean, what more could you ask for in a summer movie? The audience that I was with, they seemed to love it. Nobody was at least texting around me or talking or chomping too loud on the popcorn. So I think it's a good summer movie. It's simple. It's sweet. It's the kind of movie that you can, you know, have spent a couple of hours just having fun visiting another country and watching. And Amanda Seyfried, I think, is a, you know, nice young actress, and we've seen her in Mamma Mia, and she was in. Is she in
Chloe? I just saw her in Chloe, which I want to talk about in just a second. But let's go first to a caller who's on the line from Ames. John in Ames, go ahead with your comments, please.
Hey, guys, I don't want to get off topic here, but I watch that review show at the movies. It just got canceled. I think it'll get canceled this fall is what they said. And it's got the reviewer from the New York Times and the guy from the Chicago Tribune. And about it, you know, I've been watching it.
I think he's
the
Chicago Sun-Times, I think, isn't he?
Oh, okay. And I've been watching for about a year. I just TiVo it, and I watch it. And so initially those guys are hard on everything, and I kind of agree with them because I think only about 10% of the movies out there are interesting to me at all. And I kind of always was kind of more in agreement with them. Well, since it got canceled, those guys have gotten really soft on everything. And, oh, everything's so good. Now, I mean, some of it's just horrible. And I'm like, and it's almost their personalities have totally changed. And I just thought maybe you guys have an opinion on that, or maybe they're, you know, something like maybe they're sucking up and trying to, you know, get on some red carpet list or something like that. I don't know if you guys had, if you follow that show at all, or if you had opinions.
Well, I'll have you know I followed that show when it was originally the Ebert and Siskel thing way back in the mid-70s. That was about the time I started reviewing for the Ames Tribune, and I thought, gee, isn't that great? They're going to the stratosphere, and I'm here in Ames. But I shouldn't compare myself with them because they were terrific. These two guys, I think, are very good, and I've enjoyed watching them. But Channel 8, for reasons only they will explain, have run that show incredibly late on Sunday night. I don't have a TiVo, so I have to stay up to watch them. And I invariably fall asleep during the middle of the thing and miss a couple of reviews. But I don't know whether I could say they've softened up their comments since. They still, I think, said see it or skip it. I mean, rather skip it or rent it on maybe half of the films that they reviewed. But I don't agree with them on everything either. I think the key is you figure out what there is about a reviewer that you trust, and then you use that as a guide. One thing I remember about both Ebert and Siskel is they would criticize a film, but they would always look for something in it that might be worth watching, a performance or some subplot or something, and they would always point that out, and then you could decide if you wanted to endure the movie to see that particular aspect of it.
One of the things you need to remember as a reviewer is that you've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of movies, and the average moviegoer has, in fact, not seen hundreds or thousands of movies, and you may have seen, we were just talking about a romantic comedy, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of romantic comedies, and so you can sort of figure it out when the film begins, but your audience may not have, and I think you need to keep your audience in mind, as at least I try to do here in Central Iowa. You know, what is an audience looking for in a movie? And in Letters to Juliet, if you're looking for a sort of soft, fun summer movie, you've got it. Is it a great film? No.
All right, John, thanks for the call. We need to take a break. We're on Movie Day with Lauren Soleil and Tom Beal. I'm Rob Dillard. Good morning, and welcome back to Talk of Iowa. It's Movie Day. I'm Rob Dillard, in with Tom Beal and Lauren Soleil, talking about the movies currently showing. Lauren, you had mentioned Amanda Seyfried, the rising young actress who stars in Letters to Juliet. I mentioned I saw her recently in a film called Chloe, which I highly recommend. It's directed by Adam Egoyan, the Canadian film director. Stars Julianne Moore and Liam Neeson.
This is based on a French original, right?
I believe that's correct, yeah. Amanda Seyfried plays a prostitute hired by Julianne Moore to seduce her husband, Liam Neeson, because she thinks he's having all sorts of affairs, kind of a strange way of thinking of how to prove that. But it's a movie that has some sinister qualities to it, very mysterious, leaves a lot of questions open, written by a young woman named Erin Wilson. And I have somewhat of an attachment to Erin. My partner used to teach at a girls' school in the San Francisco area, and one of her students when she was in elementary school was this Erin Wilson, who's now writing screenplays like Chloe. She's also the author of Secretary. I don't know if you remember that film some years ago, but that's my connection to that film, and I enjoyed it very much, and I recommend it.
We probably talked too much about about this small film, and we probably should talk about Robin Hood, because that's the movie that's
right.
getting a lot of the buzz now. I hate to use the word prequel, but what Ridley Scott, who directed it, and Russell Crowe, who had a lot to do with producing and developing the film, what they tried to do was to go back before the, as they say, the legend, because that's where the film ends, the legend begins, before the Robin Hood that we know, and provide a kind of backstory to this man who becomes the outlaw living in Sherwood Forest with his merry band. And so this film really begins with the Robin character as an archer with the returning army of Richard the Lionhearted, as he works his way across Europe, plunders his way across Europe on his way back to England, which, of course, is now destitute because he's bankrupted with his crusading enterprise.
Plus, he had to be ransomed, remember?
Right, and then he had to be ransomed. So, at any rate, and of course, he's killed in a siege, shot through the neck with a crossbow dart. And the army then is dispersing and coming back to England. And we do have, you know, King John is now king. And he plays the sort of feckless British monarch that we've seen, again, in the movies. Played, incidentally, by a man named Oscar Isaac. I think does a good job of being simpering and comic, or simperingly comic, or comically simpering, anyway. But it does a good job, I think, doing that. Anyway, so Russell Crowe comes back, takes on a different personality from what he was. He was just an archer, and the plot is way too complicated to explain this whole thing. But anyway, he comes back, assumes the persona of Locksley, Robin of Locksley, and returns home to his ancestral home. He has promised Locksley, who in fact died, that he would return a famous sword to his father, played by Max von Sydow, and to his wife, who's played by Kate Blanchett. So that's the way things start. King John is now bankrupt, and so he's going to retax the people. And the guy who's going to do that is in league with the French, and they're going to invade England, which, of course, is the fear that England had ever since Caesar crossed the Channel and conquered England for the Romans. And so this plot gets thicker and thicker as the story develops. And the evil guys, of course, are plundering the countryside, and at some point need to be stopped. And the barons must come together and stop the French. So there's all of this together in something of at times a plot mishmash. But overall, I think the thing works in an odd sort of way. Russell Crowe is good in this kind of role. They've got some good supporting characters. Eileen Atkins plays Eleanor of Aquitaine, who's John's mother, also Richard's mother. John refers to himself as the runt of the litter. Max von Sydow plays Locksley. And Mark Strong, who's become the evil man of British films, he's tall, he's dark, he shaves his head, is the evil baron who's out to collaborate with the French and rape the British countryside. In some strange kinds of way, this all fits together.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought historical movies are interesting even when the filmmakers take some liberties. And here we're dealing with a legend anyway, so you could take lots of liberties and may not be wrong at all. It might be actually the way it turned out. But I thought the fact that they could use special effects, computer-generated imagery, to enhance the look of the period was really interesting. There's one dramatic scene where the ship bringing Robin Hood, whose name in the movie is Robin Longstride, anyway, bringing him posing as a knight to return the king's crown. And he's going up the Thames, and of course they don't have the modern buildings, but what you see is the great Tower of London, or the castle, wherever the royal family resided at that period. And it's really a great shot, and you kind of get a sense of what it's like. It's a big contrast with the famous 1938 Technicolor version. In that case, the film was in just vivid color, almost neon-like colors. And here it's a much darker picture, and probably more typical of the overcast skies in Britain and so on. There is a great scene in the movie which really draws the contrast between the 38 version of Richard the Lionhearted and this version. Richard's, if you research Richard, you discover he's not the charming, lovable regent that we've grown to love or to believe existed. In any case, the king has had some problems, and at some point he has a number of his men gathered around him, and he said, "Is there anyone here, you know, who can tell me the truth? In effect, speak truth to me." And Robin foolishly speaks up and tells him that he had lost respect for him because he had ordered the killing of maybe 1,000 captives during their fight in the Middle East. And he said, I just lost my respect for you. And the king had said he wanted people to speak freely to him and implied, if you did, that he would respect you for it. But the very next shot shows Robin and about half a dozen of his closest friends all in the stocks, and that's the price you pay for speaking to power, frankly.
It's interesting. The king is played by Danny Houston, who's, of course, the son of famous son John Houston and grandson of Walter Houston, the actor that dynasty continues on. There's some silly bits in the film, and I don't want to go through a lot of them because they're sort of surprises, but Kate Blanchett ends up taking up arms in a way that seems odd, and this Robin, who's just a humble archer, seems to have graces that he can... So he dances well and these kinds of things, and you think, given his social position in this court, he would probably not have these skills. But I agree with Tom. It has a great look. You know, the rustics seem rustic and you know, hygienically compromised, as they do in all medieval films.
It's directed by Ridley Scott. Is that right? Ridley Scott directed.
Yes, Ridley. Right.
And he has a lot of experience directing action pictures.
Right, and the action sequences are, you know, well done, chaotic, crazy in the way that they would be. I think the film works if you like period pieces and if you don't mind. There's a fair amount of violence in it. If you don't mind a fair amount of sort of the banging people in, you know, helmeted heads with clubs kind of warfare. So, but the evil guys are evil and the good guys are good, and it seems, you know, and it all works out in the end.
I want to get an email in from a former student of yours, Tom, a guy named Mark Lunsman, I believe it's pronounced. And he says, it seems to me in this discussion of 3D, as we were in the previous half hour talking about, as the next big thing, that most of what I'm hearing could have been said about Technicolor in the 1930s and 40s. Several big splashy movies were made in that format then, The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind. But that eventually faded. Is 3D eventually to suffer the same fate?
He's asking. It didn't fade early. I remember even as a kid growing up in the, well, I was a real young kid in the 40s, but that in color was still being heavily promoted because not all movies were made in color. There were still a lot of black and white films and very excellent ones made into the 60s even. And so it became a standard. Now, you know, it's difficult to get many young people to even watch a black and white movie. So color has become an essential part of a film. I guess the caller or the email writer, my former student, is suggesting that 3D may reach that stage. But you can watch color without putting on glasses, and it's a much easier process. I don't know of anyone who's gotten a headache watching a color movie, but you certainly can. Some people just have trouble dealing with this 3D concept. At the moment, I think it's still a bit of a gimmick. I know Spielberg and others have said they can make it an integral part of the filmmaking process. And when they do, then perhaps it will be accepted in much the same way that color has been. But I think it has a ways to go yet.
One more email before we get back to talking about the films. This comes from a gentleman in the Quad Cities area, and he was just wondering if many international films come to theaters. He enjoys Japanese films and looking forward to one called Outrage that's out there in theaters now. He wants to know what the likelihood of those kinds of films coming to Iowa and especially in the Quad Cities. I can speak for someone who used to book for a movie theater here in Des Moines that there are some art houses. We've got a couple of them in Des Moines that will occasionally bring in a international film. But what a lot of art houses find, there's just not a big enough audience for those kinds of films.
Well, I think there's been some maturing of American audiences over the last 20 years or so, one being that they are much more receptive to foreign films than they used to be, and that they're willing to put up with at least a certain number of subtitles or dubbed films, which I remember when I was growing up, absolutely they wouldn't put up with that, wouldn't go to see such a film unless it was in an art house and you might get a cup of coffee when you went to see it. But I think the industry has become so much more international, and there are some really great films being made in these countries that are getting wider distribution. Iowa, I think, is a challenge, and you as a former booker would probably agree, as long as film is still being the primary means by which films are distributed, they strike only a limited number of prints because they are expensive to make, and Iowa is not high on the list of places for those films to go. Often when they do arrive, the prints have been shown many times, they're scratched, and they're not, you know, the highest quality. Now, maybe when films are increasingly distributed on a form of DVD or by satellite, maybe we're going to see an opportunity for more of these international films to be shown. But it costs so much money to promote these pictures, and it does occupy a screen, and even when you have a multiplex, you've got to generate a certain amount of money to make them work. And Iowans are not particularly noted for their acceptance of international films. Loring, you were shaking your head too earlier that you didn't think that there was much hope of our seeing more films.
No, in fact, one of the reasons that I subscribe to Netflix, there are a number of other DVD programs where you can get stuff through the mail, is because that's my source for international movies, is through a subscription service like that, because they simply don't play.
Cinemax,
certainly don't play here in Ames.
Cinemax used to show a number of international films. I'm not a subscriber now, but that was another way I got to see some of them.
Do you guys have any thoughts on the death this week of Dennis Hopper?
I'm surprised he lasted as long as he did, given his lifestyle.
Yeah.
Drug use, alcohol, whatever. It's very interesting. People forget that he started out in Rebel Without a Cause and was a teenage actor before he became the sort of iconic character in the hippie or the alternate films of the 1960s, early 70s. So he has this career as a kind of kid actor, and then this later sort of middle career where he did absolutely bizarre kinds of strange kinds of films. You think of Easy Rider or, I don't know, Blue Velvet. And right. Then a later part of his career where he played I don't know, sweeter, more interest, more conventional kind of characters. I think of the character he plays in Hoosiers, for example.
Right.
Sort of an interesting career trajectory.
You know, his Easy Rider film was such a success that he was able to get funding for a film called The Last Movie in 1971. $850,000 the studio gave him to make this film, and it was a mess. I had a chance to see it in a rough cut in Madison when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, and Hopper himself brought it in. There was a huge crowd. Madison was quite a movie town, and he said, "Now, I want to stress, this is a rough cut, so don't expect it to hang together perfectly." So we looked at it, and there were little patches of brilliance to this thing, but I remember thinking at the time, he's not going to be able to pull this together. It's too disjointed. And of course, it was a major flop, and that pretty well set him back quite a bit. But the story is told that he was drinking a quart of liquor every day that he made that film. He directed it.
I think he got up to a gallon of rum a day.
So. Can you imagine how can anybody survive that?
Well, I think he'd be remembered for the series of very often very interesting but sort of quirky little roles that he did. And at least that's the way.
Well, he was in Apocalypse Now, so yeah. He'll have. Say, can I mention two movies quickly that are based on games? And I wanted to quickly say that I like to judge a movie based on its. On it being a movie, not its derivation. But the two movies are Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, which had so much promise and looked like it might actually launch a new action figure in the name of Jake Gyllenhaal. And the other one was MacGruber. MacGruber's turning out to be one of the giant flops of the summer so far. It's based on a game. I've never played the game. I only looked at the movie. I have to tell you, I thought it was a dreadful movie. And I'm not surprised that it only took in $1.5 million, almost less than $2 million last week. It just is really bombing. The Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, however, with a lot of faults, is doing pretty well. Worldwide, it's taken in $133 million. However, it costs $200 million to make and $100 million to market. So they have a ways to go. But this is a story that really typifies what I would say is a summer movie. A lot of action, not too dense a plot, a lot more money spent on this than the movies I saw when I was a kid in the summer, but nevertheless, lots of action. And this is a case, you got a mysterious knife that when filled with the proper sand, can take you back in time. And there's a pretty darn good cast, incidentally. Jake Gyllenhaal plays the star, this kind of a kid from poverty who's plucked out of obscurity and becomes an adopted son of the king. And then you have Ben Kingsley. One of the best performances is by Alfred Molina, who plays a guy who, his name is Sheikh Amar. He runs, believe it or not, ostrich races. And this is a guy who's kind of a crook, but becomes a lovable helper to Jake Gyllenhaal's character as he tries to get this knife, because he learns that if he doesn't get this weapon, which has the ability to take them back in time, there's going to be something terrible will happen. Specifically, his family will disappear because somebody wants to rewrite time. And so visually, pretty colorful. In fact, someone said this is the orangest movie to come along in a long time. Incidentally, teabaggers will enjoy Alfred Molina because he is forever spouting anti-government comments and he hates taxes. So there's that appeal, contemporary appeal.
I want to get in another email because it's sort of promoting a movie that was produced here in Iowa. It's called Splatter, Love, Honor, Paintball. It was an Iowa-produced, written, and directed feature comedy with a large cast of Iowa actors and filmed by Iowans. It was shot in southeast Iowa in 2009, and it premieres in Los Angeles June 8th at the Dances with Films Festival. You can find details on that on Facebook, and that's from Paul Burge, who down in Indianola. Thanks, Paul, for letting us know about that film.
Well, there was that burst of filmmaking there for a while. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. The scandal may have killed that off for a time.
Yeah, Yeah. Anything else we should be looking for?
Well,
I saw
Yeah, I saw Iron Man 2, and I think it's still around, directed by John Favreau, with, of course, Robert Downey Jr. playing the Iron Man slash Tony Stark. And I'm not a big comic book movie fan, but I really enjoyed this. I thought it was funny. I mean, laugh out loud funny, not just unintentionally funny. Had great little performances. The performance I got to single out is Mickey Rourke, who plays Ivan Venko, the bad guy. He's a guy in this film, looks like he was made out of spare parts. Of course, did very well at the Academy Awards last year. But you've got all kinds of... Gary Shandling appears in a brief role as Senator Stern, and in his usual sort of fumbling sort of way. Paul Bettany appears in this as the voice of Jarvis, the computer. John Slattery, who's been in Mad Men, his career, and he's in this. Don Cheadle plays Rhodey Road, the lieutenant colonel. Scarlett Johansson plays a character. Sam Rockwell is in this. Samuel L. Jackson appears, although God knows why. It's one of these sort of throwaway little roles. Of course, Gwyneth Paltrow appears as Pepper Potts, the poor woman who's trying to keep Tony Stark into some sort of orbit, at least around the Earth. There's the usual, technical stuff and CGI stuff and bad guys and lots of shooting and whatever. But I really had a good time with it.
And we have to wrap it up there. As always, I can talk movies with you guys forever, but we'll have to stop for today. Thanks to Lauren Soleil and Tom Beal for being with me on Movie Day from Talk of Iowa. It's produced by Dennis Reese with production assistance today from Christoph Mai and John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime by going to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Rob Dillard. Thanks for listening.